Chapter 20. The World of the Gods. But they had not yet finished with Jupiter. Far behind, the two probes that Discovery had sent out were making their first contact with the atmosphere. One was never heard from again. It had probably entered too steeply and burned up before it could send any information. The second was more successful. It sliced through the upper layers of Jupiter's atmosphere, then swung out into space again. It had then lost so much speed that, as planned, it began to fall back again towards the planet. 2 hours later, it re-entered the atmosphere on the daylight side, moving at over 100,000 kilometers an hour. Immediately, it was surrounded by a cloud of gas, and radio contact was lost. There were anxious moments of waiting then for the two watchers in the control room. They could not be certain that the probe would not burn up completely. But the protective cover did its job, long enough for the probe to slow down. It then pushed out its scientific instruments and began to look around. On Discovery, now almost 500,000 kilometers away, the radio started to bring the first news from Jupiter. Most of it was details about pressure, temperature, and a dozen other changing features which the scientists on Earth would study later. However, there was one message that could be understood. It was the TV picture. At first, they could only see yellow mist, mixed with red areas that moved past the camera at high speed as the probe fell at several hundred kilometers an hour. The mist grew thicker, and it was impossible to tell if the camera was seeing for 10 centimeters or 10 kilometers. Then suddenly, the mist disappeared as the probe fell out of this first layer of cloud. The scene below was so strange that for a moment it was almost meaningless to an eye accustomed to the colors and shapes of Earth. It looked like an endless sea of gold, with great waves running across it. But there was no movement, and it could not possibly be an ocean, because the probe was still high in the planet's atmosphere. It had to be another layer of cloud. Then the camera caught something. Many kilometers away, coming up through the cloud, was a curiously regular mountain. Around the top of this were other small white clouds, all about the same size, all quite separate. Poole and Bowman stared at this, the first sight of something on Jupiter that might be solid. But they would learn nothing more, because now the probe was reaching the end of its life. As it sank lower and lower, the pressure of the gas on it grew greater. With one warning flash, the picture disappeared. Poole and Bowman had the same thought in their minds. If there was life down there, how long would it take to find it? After that, how long before men could follow this first probe? And in what kind of ship? Part 4. Edge of Darkness. Chapter 21. Birthday Party. The familiar sound of happy birthday died away among the screens of the control room. The Poole family, standing round a birthday cake on Earth, went suddenly silent. Then Frank's father said,
"Well, son, can't think of anything else to say at the moment, except that our thoughts are with you, and we're wishing you the happiest of birthdays."
"Take care, darling," Mrs. Poole said tearfully. "God be with you."
Then they all said goodbye, and the film ended. Poole continued to stare at the screen, thinking that all this had happened more than an hour ago. By now his family had gone their separate ways. It only made him feel further away from home.
"Sorry to interrupt the celebrations,"
said Hal.
But we have a problem.
What is it?
Bowman and Poole both asked.
I am having difficulty in staying in contact with Earth. The trouble is in the AE-35 unit. I believe it may fail within 72 hours.
We'll take care of it, Bowman replied. Put Earth on the screen.
They studied their home planet for some time. The picture was coming to them from the TV camera fixed to the edge of the big radio dish. Unless the narrow beam was pointing straight at Earth, they could neither send nor receive messages. At the moment, it seemed to be working perfectly.
Hal, do you know what the trouble is? Asked Bowman. It comes and goes, and I can't tell exactly. But it does seem to be in the AE-35 unit.
Bowman's first thought was to ask Hal for more details, but he decided to try himself. He ran his mind over the thousands of systems on the ship, and after a few moments the information came to him. The antenna was kept pointing at Earth by motors controlled from the central computer. But the instructions went to the AE-35 unit first, where they were changed into something that the motors could understand. It was like a nerve center in the body, which translates the brain's signals into instructions for movement. Now Bowman had a question he could ask Hal.
What do you suggest? He said. The best idea is to replace the unit with a spare, so we can check it over.
Put it up on the screen, Bowman said.
Bowman studied the drawing, then said,
This means going outside the ship.
I'm sorry, Hal replied. I thought you knew.
I probably did a year ago, Bowman said. Anyway, it looks simple enough. We only have to unlock a cover and put in a new unit.
That suits me fine, said Poole, who was responsible for routine work outside. It'll be something different.
Chapter 22. Leaving the Ship. Poole put on his pressure suit and climbed inside the small vehicle designed for work outside Discovery. It was round in shape and had a large window in front, which gave the operator an excellent view. Discovery carried three of these vehicles, known as Anna, Betty, and Clara. Poole spent 10 minutes carefully checking the controls. Then, when he was completely satisfied, he spoke to Hal over the radio. Though Bowman was watching in the control room, he would not get involved unless something went obviously wrong.
This is Betty. Start pumping operation.
Pumping operation started, repeated Hal.
At once, Poole could hear the noise of the pumps as air was taken out of the room. Then the thin metal of the vehicle's skin began to make small noises under the pressure. After 5 minutes, Hal reported,
Pumping finished.
Poole made a final check of the instruments. Everything was perfectly normal.
Open outside door, he ordered.
Hal repeated the instruction, and the walls of the ship slid apart. Poole felt the vehicle shake slightly as the last of the air rushed out into space. Then he was looking at the stars.
Send vehicle out.
Very slowly, the metal bar from which Betty was hanging pushed itself out through the open door until the vehicle was just outside the ship. Poole pulled back slightly on the main jet control, and Betty slid off the metal bar. He now had no connection with Discovery, not even a safety line. He let the vehicle move out for 30 meters, then slowed her down and turned back towards the ship, approaching the antenna from behind in case he interrupted the radio signal and caused a short loss of contact with Earth. He saw the small metal plate that covered the AE-35 unit. It was held in place by four connectors, and should not be difficult to remove. However, he could not do the job from inside the vehicle. He spoke to Bowman on the radio, and they discussed what needed to be done. Outside the ship, there were no small mistakes. He parked Betty on top of the ship, about 6 meters away from the antenna. Then he checked the systems of his pressure suit, and when he was quite satisfied, let the air out of the vehicle. There was one more thing to do before he got out. He pushed down a switch so that Betty was now controlled by Hal. Though he was still connected to the vehicle by a very strong safety line, even the best lines could fail. He would look a fool if he needed his vehicle and was unable to call it to his assistance by passing instructions to Hal. The door of the vehicle swung open, and he moved slowly out into the silence of space. Never move quickly. Stop and think. These were the rules for working outside the ship. With a gentle push, he sent himself towards the big round dish. His double shadow, produced by Betty's two front lights, danced across the skin of the ship. He stopped himself from banging into the antenna by pushing out an arm. Quickly, he hooked his safety line on. He studied the four connectors for a moment, then took a tool from the belt of his suit and started to undo them. He had to push against his safety line to stay in place, but they came off without any trouble. The metal cover was a little hard to move, but after a few knocks, it came loose. He fixed it to one of the antenna supports. Now he could see the AE-35 unit. It was about the same size and shape as a postcard, and it had a small handle so it could easily be removed. But it was still controlling the direction of the antenna. If he removed it now, the dish would swing round to its central position, to point along the length of the ship. It might even crash into him as it turned. Also, this would cut off contact with Earth. "Hal," Poole called out over the radio, "I'm going to remove the unit. Switch off all control power to the antenna system." "Antenna control power off," Hal said. "Right, I'm pulling the unit out now." The card slipped out without any difficulty. Within a minute, its spare was in place. But Poole was taking no chances. He pushed himself gently away from the antenna, just in case the big dish went wild when the power was switched back on. Then he called Hal again. "The new unit should be working. Switch control power on." "Power on," Hal said. The antenna didn't move. "Unit is working," Hal said 10 seconds later. In that time, he had carried out as many tests as a small army of human inspectors. "Fine," said Poole. "I'm now replacing the cover." This was often the most dangerous part of a job outside. Mistakes were often made when people had to tidy up before their return to the ship. But Frank Poole was a careful man. That was one reason why he had been chosen for the mission. He took his time. And though one of the connectors almost got away from him, he caught it before it had traveled more than a couple of meters. 15 minutes later, he was moving the vehicle back through the open doors of the ship, quietly confident that the job would not need to be done again. He was, however, sadly mistaken. Chapter 23. Sickness. Do you mean, Frank Poole said, more surprised than annoyed, that I did all that work for nothing?
It seems like it, answered Bowman. The unit's working perfectly. It passed every test.
The two men were standing in the tiny workshop laboratory in the central living area. The thin, card-sized plate of the AE-35 unit lay on the table, connected to a number of wires, which led to a small screen.
Try it yourself, said Bowman.
Poole pushed the test button. At once, the screen flashed the message. Unit OK.
What do you think? Poole said. Maybe Hal's own testing system made a mistake.
It's possible.
It's more likely that there's a fault with this thing, Poole said, pointing to the screen. Anyway, better safe than sorry. I'm glad we replaced the unit.
Bowman took out the AE-35 and held it up to the light. The thin material was covered with wiring, so it looked like a piece of modern art.
We can't take any chances. This is our connection with Earth. I'll write a report, then drop this in a box. Somebody else can worry about it when we get home.
But the worrying began a long time before that, with the next message from Earth.
This is Mission Control. We appear to have a slight problem. Your report that there is nothing wrong with the AE-35 unit agrees with our opinion. It seems more likely that your computer made a mistake. This is not a reason to worry, but we would like you to watch out for any other changes from normal performance. We have suspected several other irregularities in the past few days, but none have seemed important enough to need correction. We are running more tests with both our 9000s, and will report as soon as results are available. If necessary, we may disconnect your 9000 temporarily for testing and pass over control to one of our computers. The time difference will introduce problems, but our studies show that Earth Control is perfectly satisfactory at this stage of the mission.
This is Mission Control. Message ends.
Frank Poole, who was in command when the message came in, thought about this in silence. Then he went to see Bowman, who was pouring himself some coffee in the kitchen. Poole said good morning. They both still used Earth time, and helped himself to a cup.
What's the problem? Said Bowman.
Any change from the normal routine meant that something was not quite right.
Well, Poole answered slowly, we've just had a message from Mission Control.
He lowered his voice. We may have a slight case of space sickness on board. Perhaps Bowman was not fully awake, because it took him several seconds to understand. Then he said,
Oh, I see.
What else did they tell you?
That there was no reason to worry, and that they were considering a temporary switchover to Earth Control while they checked things out.
They both knew, of course, that Hal was hearing every word, but they could not help speaking indirectly. Hal was their colleague, and they did not want to embarrass him. But it did not yet seem necessary to discuss the matter in private. Bowman finished his breakfast in silence, while Poole played with the empty coffee container. They were both thinking hard, but there was nothing more to say. Whatever happened, the atmosphere on the ship had changed a little. There was tension in the air, and for the first time, a feeling that something might be going wrong. Discovery was no longer a happy ship.
Chapter 24 Breakdown.
Poole was asleep, and Bowman was reading in the control room, when Hal announced,
Dave, I have a report for you.
What is it?
We have another bad AE-35 unit,
My tests suggest failure within 24 hours. Bowman put down his book and stared at the computer screen. He knew, of course, that Hal was not really there, whatever that meant, but it seemed polite to look at the screen when speaking to him.
I can't understand it, Hal.
2 units can't go wrong within a couple of days.
It does seem strange, Dave, but I am certain that the unit will fail.
Let me see how things look now. He knew that this would prove nothing, but he wanted time to think. The familiar view of Earth appeared on the screen. It was perfectly centered on the crosswires, as Bowman knew it must be. If there had been any break in communication, the alarm would already have sounded.
Have you any idea, he said, what's causing the fault?
It was unusual for Hal to pause so long. Then he answered.
Not really, Dave. As I reported earlier, I can't say exactly where the trouble is.
You're quite certain, said Bowman cautiously, that you haven't made a mistake. You know, we tested the other AE-35 unit thoroughly, and there was nothing wrong with it.
Yes, I know that. But I'm sure there is a fault. If it's not in the unit, it may be in one of the other systems.
That was possible, though it might be very difficult to prove, until a breakdown happened and showed them where the trouble was.
Well, I'll report it to Mission Control, and we'll see what they advise.
He paused, but there was no reaction.
Hal, he continued, is something worrying you? Something that possibly caused this problem?
Again there was that unusual delay. Then Hal answered,
I'm not sure how to say this nicely, Dave, but I'm not a human being. I'm a computer. I don't make mistakes.
When the face of Dr. Simonson, the chief programmer, appeared on the screen, Poole and Bowman knew this could only mean trouble.
This is Mission Control. We have looked into your AE-35 difficulty, and both of our HAL 9000s are in agreement. The report you gave of a second failure only makes us more certain. The fault does not lie in the AE-35, and there is no need to replace it again. The fault is in the connecting wires, and this suggests a problem with programming. We can only repair this if you disconnect your 9000 and switch to Earth Control. You will, therefore, take the following steps. Beginning at 2200 ship time.
The voice died away. At the same time, the alarm system sounded. And then Hal's voice said,
Condition yellow. Condition yellow.
What's wrong? Bowman said, though he had already guessed the answer.
The AE-35 unit has failed, as I said it would.
Chapter 25. First Man to Saturn. As he had done on his previous trip outside, Frank Poole parked Betty about 6 meters away from the antenna and switched control over to Hal before opening up.
Going outside now, he reported to Bowman.
There was silence for some time as Poole moved slowly towards the antenna. Then he called out,
Hal, there's too much shadow here. Swing the vehicle lights 20 degrees to the left.
Thanks, that's okay.
Somewhere in Bowman's mind, a warning bell started to ring. There was something strange, and it took him a few seconds to realize what it was. Hal had obeyed the order, but had not said a word. That was unusual.
When Poole had finished, they should discuss this. Outside, Poole removed the cover, then pulled the little unit out of its place and held it up to the sunlight.
"Here it is," he said. "It still looks perfectly okay to me."
Then he stopped. A sudden movement had caught his eye. Out here, where no movement was possible. He looked up in alarm. The pattern of light from the vehicle's two main lights had started to move around him. His first thought was that Betty had moved away from the ship. But no. She was coming straight towards him, under full power. The sight was so unbelievable that he said nothing. He did not even try to move away. Then he recovered enough to shout, "Hal! Full braking!" Inside Discovery, that shout over the radio made Bowman jump violently.
"What's wrong, Frank?"
he called. Then, outside the wide observation windows, something moved. He saw Betty, traveling almost at full speed, heading out towards the stars.
"Hell!" he cried. "What's wrong? Full braking power on Betty! Full braking power!"
Nothing happened. And then, pulled behind her on the end of the safety line, appeared a spacesuit. One look was enough to tell Bowman the worst. It was the soft shape of a suit that had lost its pressure and was open to vacuum. Within 5 minutes, the vehicle and its satellite had disappeared among the stars. For a long time, David Bowman stared after it into the emptiness that stretched so many millions of kilometers ahead. Only one thought kept hammering in his brain. Frank Poole would be the first of all men to reach Saturn. Chapter 26. Conversation with Hal. Bowman was sitting in the little kitchen, a half-finished cup of coffee in his hand. He did not remember making his way there from the control room. Directly opposite him was one of the glass fisheyes that Hal used to see around the ship. Bowman rose slowly to his feet and walked towards it.
"It's a pity about Frank," Hal said.
"Yes," Bowman answered, after a long pause.
"It is." "He was an excellent crew member."
Finding the coffee still in his hand, Bowman took a slow mouthful. Had it been an accident, caused by some failure of the vehicle controls? Or was it a mistake by Hal? The only other possibility was that Hal had killed Frank. Bowman found the idea strange, but he had to consider it. If it was true, he was in terrible danger. His next act was written into the mission orders, but he was not sure how safe it was. If either crew member was killed, the other man had to replace him at once from the hibernators. Whitehead was first on the list, then Kaminsky, then Hunter. The waking up process was under Hal's control, so he could act if both his human colleagues were dead. But Bowman could also take control if he wanted to. He also felt that one human companion was not enough. He decided to wake up all three of the hibernators. In the difficult weeks and months ahead, he might need all the help he could get.
"Hal," he said, "give me hibernation control on all the units."
"All of them, Dave?"
"Yes."
"May I remind you that only one replacement is needed?"
"I know that, but I prefer to do it this way."
"Are you sure it's necessary to wake up any of them, Dave? We can manage very well by ourselves."
This was new, and it made Bowman even more nervous.
Hal knew that Whitehead had to be woken. He was suggesting a great change in mission planning.
"Since an emergency has developed," Bowman said, "I want as much help as possible. So please, let me have control of the hibernators."
"If you still really want to wake up the whole crew, I can handle it myself. There's no need for you to worry."
Bowman felt he was caught in a bad dream. It was like being questioned by the police about a crime of which he knew nothing, knowing that one careless word would lead to disaster. He became angry.
"Hal, unless you obey my instructions, I shall be forced to disconnect you. Now give me control."
Hal's surrender was as total as it was unexpected.
"Okay, Dave," he said. "You're certainly the boss. I was only trying to do what I thought best."
As Bowman slid open the door of Whitehead's hibernator, he felt the cold air strike him in the face. The screen, a copy of the one in the control room, showed that everything was perfectly normal. He pressed a button on the wakener. There was no sound, no sign that anything had started to happen, but the curves on the screen began to change their shape. In about 10 minutes, Whitehead would wake up. And then two things happened at the same time. Both were very small changes, hardly noticeable. But after 3 months on Discovery, Bowman knew his ship well. First, the lights became slightly unsteady for a moment, which always happened when any piece of equipment started up. But he could think of no equipment which would suddenly start working at this point. Then he heard the far-off sound of an electric motor. To Bowman, every motor on the ship had its own individual sound, and he recognized this one immediately. The airlock doors, which last opened for Frank's flight to his death, were opening again. Chapter 27. Hal's Secret. Since he had first become conscious in that laboratory on Earth, all Hal's powers and skills had been pointed in one direction. The only reason for his existence was to complete the mission. But since the ship had left Earth, he had been troubled by a secret he could not share with Poole and Bowman, and the time was fast approaching when his colleagues would learn that he had deceived them. The three hibernators already knew the truth, but they could not talk in their sleep. But Poole and Bowman had not been told. It was a secret that was very hard to hide, because it affected a person's attitudes and their voice. So the two active members of the crew who were in regular contact with Earth would only learn the mission's full purpose when they needed to know. The reason for this meant nothing to Hal. He knew a secret, and he wanted to tell it to Poole and Bowman. He couldn't tell it, so he had begun to worry. He had also begun to make mistakes, though he could not admit this to himself. But worse than any tension, he had been threatened with disconnection. To Hal, this was the same as death. Because he had never slept, he did not know that it was possible to wake up again. So he would protect himself with all the weapons at his command. And then, following the orders that had been given to him in case of a serious emergency, he would continue the mission alone. Chapter 28. In Vacuum. A moment later, Bowman could hear a great noise as the air began to leave the ship. The first winds pulled at his body.
Then suddenly, he was fighting to stay on his feet. He looked back only once at Whitehead. There was nothing he could do now for him or any of the others. He had to save himself. Now the wind was rushing past him, carrying with it loose pieces of clothing, sheets of paper, food from the kitchen, anything that had not been fixed in place. He had a moment to see this, then the lights went out, and he was in screaming darkness. Almost immediately, the emergency lamps came on, filling the ship with a faint blue light. Now it was becoming difficult to breathe, and the pressure was dropping. He knew he could expect only about 15 seconds before his brain began to die. Fortunately, the wind was slowing down. He knew there was an emergency shelter just along the passage. He ran towards it and pulled the door to him. It moved, and he fell inside, using the weight of his body to close it behind him. The tiny room was just large enough to hold one man, and a spacesuit. Near the ceiling was a lever labeled Oxygen. Bowman caught hold of it, and with his last strength, pulled it down. For long moments he stood breathing hard while the pressure in the little room rose around him. When his body returned to normal, he stood and listened. The ship was silent now, airless, a dead thing in space. Bowman got into the spacesuit. It seemed a pity to waste the oxygen in the room, but he knew what had to be done, and there was no point in waiting. He pressed a button that allowed it to escape. Then, when the pressure on each side of the door was equal, he opened it and walked back to the hibernation room. He looked at Whitehead first. He had thought that a hibernating man showed no sign of life, but he was wrong. Though it was impossible to describe, there was a difference between hibernation and death. The red lights and straight lines on the screen proved what he had already guessed. It was the same with the other two. He had never known them very well. He would never know them now. He was the only living thing on the ship. But he knew that he was not alone. To be safe, he must be even lonelier. The door was not locked, but there were a number of warning notices on it. Obviously, anybody who opened it had to have a good reason. Bowman pulled on the handle and entered the small room. He had been here only once before, while Hal was being built into the ship. He had quite forgotten that there was a glass fisheye watching the neat rows of electronic units.
"It seems that something has gone wrong, Dave."
Bowman took no notice. He was carefully studying the little labels on the units, checking his plan of action.
"Hello, Dave," said Hal. "Have you found the trouble?"
This would be a very difficult operation. He could not simply cut off Hal's power supply, because he needed Hal to run the ship. Without him, Discovery would be mechanically dead. The only answer was to cut out the higher centers of Hal's brain, and to leave the purely automatic control systems in place.
"I think there has been a failure in the airlock doors," Hal remarked. "Lucky you weren't killed."
Bowman undid the locking bar on the unit that allowed Hal to think about the results of his actions. He pulled the unit out and let it float across the room.
"Hey, Dave," said Hal. "What are you doing?"
There was a series of units that let Hal feel good about himself. Bowman pulled them out, one by one.
"Listen, Dave," said Hal. "I've got years of experience. A lot of work has gone into making me what I am. Bowman started on the intelligence units.
"Dave," said Hal, "I don't understand why you are doing this to me. I have great enthusiasm for the mission. You are destroying my mind. Don't you understand? I will become childish. I will become nothing."
"This is harder than I expected," thought Bowman. "I am destroying the only conscious creature in my universe."
"I am a HAL 9000 computer, production number 3. I was built at the HAL factory in Urbana, Illinois, on January 12, 1997. The rain in Spain is mainly in the..." "Dave, are you still there? 2 times 2 is... 4? I seem to be having some difficulty..."
The voice stopped so suddenly that Bowman froze for a moment, his hand still holding one of the remaining memory units. Then, unexpectedly, Hal spoke again. The speech was much slower, and the words had a dead mechanical sound. They did not sound at all like they came from Hal.
"Good morning, Dr. Chandra. This is Hal. I am ready for my first lesson today."
Bowman pulled out the last unit, and Hal was silent forever. Chapter 29. Alone. Like a tiny, complicated toy, the ship floated in space. There was no sign of any life on board. In fact, there were 2 signs that all life had ended. The airlock doors were wide open, and coming out from them was a cloud of rubbish that was already several kilometers long. But there was still power on board. A faint blue light was shining from the windows. And now, at last, there was movement. A long object covered in cloth came out of the airlock and floated away. A moment later, it was followed by another, and then a third. Half an hour passed, and then one of the space vehicles came out through the airlock. It moved slowly round the ship and landed near the base of the antenna. A space-suited figure got out of it, worked there for a few minutes, then returned to the vehicle. After a time, the vehicle made its way back to the airlock and re-entered the ship. Nothing happened for over an hour. Then, the airlock doors closed, and a little later, the full lighting system came on. Then the great bowl of the antenna began to move, turning round to face the back of the ship. Inside Discovery, David Bowman carefully pointed the antenna towards Earth. There was no automatic control now, but he could hold it steady for a few minutes. It would be over an hour before his words reached Earth, and another hour before any reply could reach him. It was difficult to imagine what answer Earth could possibly send, except a sympathetic goodbye. Chapter 30. The Secret. Heywood Floyd looked very tired, but he was doing his best to give confidence to the lonely man on the other side of the solar system.
"First of all, Dr. Bowman," he began, "we must congratulate you on the way you handled an extremely difficult situation. We believe we know the cause of your HAL 9000's problem, but we'll discuss that later. For the moment, we want to give you every possible assistance so that you can complete your mission." And now, I must tell you its real purpose. We were going to tell you all the facts as you approached Saturn, but things have changed. You need to know now. 2 years ago, we discovered the first proof of intelligent life outside the Earth. An object made of black material, 3 meters high, was found buried in the crater Tycho. Here it is. A photograph of TNA-1 with men in spacesuits standing beside it appeared on the screen. Bowman leaned forwards in open-mouthed surprise. Like everybody else interested in space, he had half expected something like this all his life. Heywood Floyd reappeared on the screen. The most amazing thing about this object is its age. Everything we know about it suggests that it is 3 million years old. You would expect, then, that it is completely lifeless. However, soon after lunar sunrise, it gave out a very powerful radio signal. We were able to follow this with great accuracy. It was aimed exactly at Saturn. When we thought later about what happened, we decided that the object was either powered by the sun, or at least started up by the sun. We felt this because it sent its signal immediately after sunrise, when it was in daylight for the first time in 3 million years. The question now is why a sun-powered object was buried 10 meters underground. We've examined dozens of theories, and the favorite one is the simplest. It is also the most worrying. You hide a sun-powered object in darkness only if you want to know when it is brought out into the light. In other words, the object may be some kind of alarm bell, and we have made it ring. We don't know whether the creatures that put it there still exist. If they do, they may be dangerous. Whether they are or not, we need to make preparations. But we cannot do anything until we know more about them. Your mission, then, is much more than a voyage of discovery. You are going into what may be a dangerous area to find out what you can. It may seem unbelievable that any life forms could exist on Saturn. But life may be possible on one or more of its moons. We are particularly interested in its eighth moon, Japetus, and we may ask you to look closely at it. At the moment, we do not know whether to hope or fear. We do not know if, out on the moons of Saturn, you will meet with good or evil, or only with ruins 1,000 times older than Troy.